Okie doke, welcome back to the programme. Good morning if you are just joining us. It's the last 9 till noon show of the week, Friday the 3rd of February 2023, and we've a long weekend. Not all of us, many of you out there working in hospitality and elsewhere probably have a busier weekend than you would ordinarily, but for a lot of people there is that long weekend. Okay, some of your comments before we welcome Seamus Gunn onto the programme to answer your legal questions. I think that if marijuana was legalised, it would be a big economic boost to the county, as well as lessen the crime rates, job creation too. Another, we all forget many of these drugs were originally created by pharmaceutical companies, which never got a licence. Ecstasy was first created as a slimming tablet, but had too many side effects and was dumped. Heroin was created to help people off, to get people off morphine. So if we want to blame anyone for the creation of these drugs, let's look closer at the big pharma companies. I think Viagra was first developed as a blood pressure treatment, but when they had the clinical trials, they all noticed something peculiar in the waiting rooms. A caller says, if we did have a railway, Donegal tourism would be booming. Add decent broadband and business would also boom, but Dublin don't want that. Another, in Athlone town, there's a population of only 1,000 people, more people than Letterkenny, yet they have a town service of 11 new electric buses. Why can't we have a service like that? This is a route out to Glenswilly, to Remelton, Newtown, Cunningham, Ballybuffet and surrounding areas. It's not rocket science. We've no public transport whatsoever. Now, a lot of people are big fans of Local Link and they do a good job for certain people, but I think people are talking about sort of expanding that out. There isn't time to build a railway from Donegal to Dublin before climate chaos ensues. We need the land more than a railway. Another, we've taken in enough refugees for now. They will never stop coming if we keep taking them in. And that's what is concerning ordinary Irish people. And I do not believe that the half of them are genuine refugees. Greg, free everything for refugees while Irish bills go through the roof. Free bus to school within walking distance. And again, you know, I know a lot of people out there have concerns, and I want to be people to be able to feel. I know people are expressing concerns and they're not racist. I know that is the case, right? I do know also, as I've said before, and I won't keep saying it, that there are some elements that are exploiting people's fears and concerns. But those fears and concerns are genuine and are coming from a very genuine place. And that is why I want that recognised when we're having that conversation, that just because someone has concerns about their area, it doesn't make them anti this or anti that, or certainly racist. Okay, they're genuine concerns, and you know, let's face it, not much is being done to ease those concerns. And it's not a bit wonder then people don't know what's going on and get extra fearful of what they perceive. We should take on Australia's guidelines and have a criteria for entering the country. I think the EU is trying to get our population up because we are underpopulated. The whole world's underpopulated, and that's going to be a big problem down the line. And I don't know, can we do that unilaterally from the EU? I know there's certain elements of certain programmes that we voluntarily signed up to. I don't know the ins and outs of that, but I just don't see us at this point, under current or even next governments, stepping outside the EU in certain areas. The Irish community has about 40 million people in the world who claim they are Irish but never set foot in this country. It works both ways. So many Irish have left here are economic migrants. We have to accept immigration works both ways. I mean, the fact is, we talk about the sad case of lots of our young people leaving here at the moment, being forced out, some would feel, not everyone. They are economic migrants, but where they're going, it's set up that they can work legally and they can rent. We don't really have that. Then when you see what's happening here. Morning, Greg. I heard that the men are coming in busloads, are being taught by the army how to fight, and they go back to their country and fight the war. Same happened in England. Rose, that's not happening here. Another, how many refugees are collecting welfare in Ireland that have returned back to their homeland? Look, we had huge populations here in the noughties that when economic things changed, they went back home, or when they got enough money together, they went home. There is a movement of population. We love it here. It's not for everyone, you know. There's lots of people living outside of Dublin at the moment who probably, as soon as they can, will move into Dublin or a city environment. They probably won't like the lifestyle around here. Let us see. Mothers are the problem. They feel threatened from people coming into the country that might interfere with... Okay, well, listen, that's from the other extreme. Refugees. With Ireland's abortion rate hitting 10,000 a year in the next century, an estimated 1 million Irish citizens will be eliminated from the country. Couple this with the current rate of influx of refugees and asylum applicants, Ireland demographics, religion, politics, culture and national identity will be unrecognisable in a few generations. Thank God, they say. I mean, we're unrecognisable in this country without the influx of anyone compared to the 80s, 70s, 50s, 40s, 30s. Beyond that, I don't know what to say. You know, if someone comes into the country without documentation, passport, they should be turned back. As my opinion, they're hiding something. A lot of people feel the same. If we supposedly live in such a rich country, then why is our health and housing in tatters? The 1% of Irish are rich, the rest of us struggle on. 2%, two people really, effectively. The top two richest people have as much money as a massive proportion of the rest of society. It's a rich country, but I'll tell you, there's not an awful lot of rich people in it. There's massive money that will be needed to be spent on infrastructure before we can welcome more people here. Hubs in the towns will really help this. If anything happens in Letterkenny, Donegal gets cut off differently. The bottom line is what we want to do, or where we want to go, or what people want of this country in terms of the health service, in terms of building houses. We do not have in this country at the moment the workforce or the skill sets in enough numbers. We're the most skilled in a lot of these areas. I'm not suggesting that, but in terms of numbers, we just simply don't have them. So if we want to, if this country is to develop like a lot of us want it to in terms of services and infrastructure and all that kind of stuff, external people are going to have to be brought in to help do that work, because there's simply none of us, not enough of us to do it. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company, Letterkenny, and Remelton and online, joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Seamus.
Morning, Greg.
Great to have you back on the show. Get your questions in to Seamus, 086 60 25,000. Right, we learnt this morning, before we get to those questions, that the government's strategy of fighting legal claims for nursing home care refunds continued following a high-level strategy review in 2017. This involved then-Minister Simon Harris and Helen McEntee, according to Internal Department of Health records. So just give us an overview of, Seamus, in your view, give us an overview of the situation that led to the government having to adopt this strategy.
Yeah, and we're in danger here, Greg, of being probably sucked into what I would call the court of public opinion rather than the court of law, because we're going right back to events 40 plus years ago, which actually gave rise to this problem in the first instance. And that was when, somewhere around the early 80s, I think it was 81 or 82, there was regulations introduced which prohibited people who were suffering from a disablement in state care from receiving their disability benefit. So that's strand one of it. And then strand two of it is that those that were in care and not able to avail of public care home assistance and accommodation, who had to go into private care homes, private nursing homes then, were charged for it. And that's the other, as it were, the other strand of it. And now it has come to light that there was a certain strategy, we call it, adopted by successive governments of the day, many of them actually. So they're all sort of tarnished. That have been involved, if at all, but they actually developed a legal strategy, we would call it, which is not unusual, and this is what sort of throws me slightly, in that there's been great political reaction to this as to how come that they can adopt such a strategy in a case. Well, the State Claims Agency do it all the time with cases. Like if you reference medical negligence actions, for example, that are dragged through the courts for years, settled without admission of liability, even though maybe at an early stage they're seen likely to be a liability, but it's very rare you see the flags being raised. So that type of strategy, I have to say, is not that unusual. There's not many people coming out and saying that, but the reason behind it, I would suggest, was that the government are responsible for keeping the coffers of the state, as it were, and they've seen the potential of really heavy cost litigation following on from this. If you have the numbers that were mentioned, upwards of 12,000 plus people who were disallowed a disablement benefit over a certain period of time, so it would run into millions. So the basically the strategy, when you look at it and you boil it down, it was to wait and see what will happen next. Will these claims materialise? In my view, they got very fortunate because they don't seem to have materialised until really now, when it's now highlighted and back in the public domain. A question does arise, though: is it in everybody's interest that these strategies are now being looked into by politicians, as it were, when the government and the executive who are charged with running the country have to make fairly, maybe sometimes difficult to say, often difficult, sometimes very unpalatable decisions, but maybe making it with the view to developing a better system
forward.
Develop, because everything evolves. So when I say we go back to 1980s, you know, we're 2023 now, 40 plus years later, the system has evolved drastically. And to be fair and to be trying to be objective rather than jump in on criticism, if you look at now what is called commonly referred to as the Fair Deal Scheme, which came in 2009, just about the time when they were settling a couple of these cases, by the way, not maybe coincidental, I have to say, but it came in 2009, and it has provided accommodation for everybody who is in need of full-time care at a cost proportionate to their income and their capacity to pay. So we've moved on from that, and there are now, statistically speaking, there's over 25,000 people in full-time care in the country. It's costing over north of $1 billion a year with the contributions from the state. So that's how we've evolved on, and I don't think that should be overlooked.
Yes,
whether or not it is now, is this going for? We're historically speaking, is this worth it at this time to be opening this up?
Well, because maybe it is. But a lot of the same, a lot of the people that have their fingerprints on this are still about at the moment. And whilst things have changed, the cover up of what went on before continues. And these are the people that we expect to make decisions in the interest of the people. It is they, okay, and it's their failings that led to a lot of people having the medical card taken off them or paying through the teeth for care when they didn't have to. It was they that made the decision. We can't pat them on the back and then say, well, fair play to you. You've made a mess there and you didn't look after the people, but now you're doing really well in looking after us, in not compensating another group of people that you were shafting. I don't really want to live in a society like that. If that is right, well, let sleeping dogs lie, Seamus. I wouldn't, especially considering then, how could you have any faith in what is to come?
Well, let's go back to the fundamentals, Greg. We live in a democracy. The people that are in the Oireachtas and the Shannon are being elected by the people. And it is their job then, when a government is formed, that's the executive. And it is their responsibility to basically run and manage the country. The legislature is the houses of the Oireachtas, and the two of them, and the president. And then we have now, not to forget, now this is basically the separation of powers, the judiciary, where if a law is seen or could be seen to be unconstitutional or could be challenged, they will interpret that. So, and we keep them all separate. But the people who make these laws and regulations are actually representing us. They are us. So you can't say that you don't want. What you do the next time round is you change them and you bring in an alternative set of representation to see
because this was being covered up, if it wasn't for a whistleblower, we would not know about this and we would be voting in the next elections blindly.
Well, not really. I mean, if it comes to that, then there are many strategies, I'm quite sure, that could be opened up by whistleblowers about government's successive past and major decisions taken. And are we now going to govern in historic terms? Are we going to govern in present terms and in what is required for this country going forward? I'm just saying to you that everything evolves. Nothing stays the same. Laws evolve. They're amended. They're updated. Look at the road traffic legislation, for example. Go back to 1961. There's nearly a Road Traffic Act every few years, the way it has developed. Strategies such as legal strategies, there's nothing new to that. So I'm saying that does it deserve the attention it is getting, for example, this week, when there are very, very significant matters in this country ongoing, of which we all know, and in the press daily. But this has now taken over our front, all front pages all this week. And last week, we were monopolised by what the cost of billboards were for 1 week.
Yeah,
the stories are developing, while real issues, I think, and I'm not saying that this isn't one, because there'll probably be a system or some type of scheme put in place to deal with this.
Okay,
and maybe that should be done.
Let me ask you a question, and this is not anti-government, right? But unfortunately, I can't sort of add a counterbalance to this, because it's the same people who have been in charge for a very long time, right? So unless we discuss and find out what went on in terms of people being in power when others were being mistreated in terms of medical card access, in terms of having to pay for their care, right? And then those same people were aware of a strategy, right, to some extent. Now, they didn't come out publicly and say, by the way, we've made a mistake here, but we've a strategy here to limit the liability of the state. That was not said publicly. So until we sort that out, how can we then have confidence that they will fairly and even-handedly develop our healthcare system going forward, or develop our housing strategy going forward? How can we trust them to make these decisions until we get a proper explanation as to the reasons they made other decisions to our disadvantage in the past? That surely, if there's anything in the public, forget the billboards and all that stuff, but if anything's in the public interest, surely it's teasing this out. And very importantly as well too, the opposition very, very clearly have to say what they will do into the future. Will they change that strategy that you talk of frustrating cases and then settling eventually on the doors of the High Court or the steps of the High Court, which happens in plain sight, which is very similar, as you've only person I've heard pointed out, is pretty similar to what was happening behind closed doors. It is happening in front of us. So the opposition have to very clearly say what they will do going forward as well. But do we not need all of this put to bed once and for all, so that we as the electorate know how those who we might elect will represent us?
Well, I think I'm not sure. Can I agree with that? Because I think there are many, many skeletons in the cupboard in this country, going back over successive governments. And if we are now to spend our time putting the microscope on those, we are going to be distracted from the very issues that you have referred to: the health, the housing, the significant and major refugee massive crisis that's on our doorsteps. Of course, we're going to be, but the remedy is in our hands, the people's hands. The legislature is appointed by the people. If the people are dissatisfied or want to change, they have the right. This is the fundamentals of our democracy. If mistakes were made, then you go down the road of looking to change the people who are in charge, and you move on from there. But you are right at one point. I have not heard as of yet how it would be dealt with differently, or what approach, whenever the hard decisions, the unpalatable decisions, would have to be made by a successive government, what they would do differently. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's not just a situation as simple as the court of public opinion says, and therefore we should all jump in. And don't forget this point, that none of these cases to which this situation refers were actually dealt with in the courts at all. So there's no decision. But the Court of Public Opinion does have the view on it that you are articulating, for sure. No doubt about that. But let's go back and put on our proper legal hats here and say, well, those regulations of 1980, whenever it was, or 81, could have been challenged. Every individual has the right to go to the courts, and every individual should do so if they have been wronged. And on challenging them, they could have pointed out that they were, as has been used the word all week, ultra-virus, that they had no legal standing at all, and they would have won their action. And then there certainly could have been a situation where you had a domino effect and many more cases came to light. Mm. That didn't happen, and events move on. We'll be interested to see what's on the headlines next week. And I probably predict that they will try to deal with this in some form or other by way of maybe a redress. But don't overlook this point, and it's just practical. Who do they deal with now? These cases are going back a number of years. Unfortunately, a lot of people that were involved or may have been the right to repayments and reimbursements may now have passed on. Mm. So is it their next of kin? Are there others going to be appointed? Remember, it was a disability for care assistance for probably during their lifetime. So are those coming after them? Will they be entitled to this? This hasn't been teased out. It's all right saying that it doesn't hold any water or that it didn't stand up legally. But where now, if there is a redress scheme, who's going to avail of that, and who will succeed to it?
Yeah.
If those that are not the proper recipients are no longer, unfortunately.
But for a lot of people, maybe actually an acceptance of what went on and some commitment to try and change going forward might draw a line under this. And maybe that's what the opposition
That is what has happened. I believe that that is what has happened, without it being highlighted, in the way in which the Nursing Home Support Scheme Act has developed over the years, and following on from that in 2009, which is a very reasonable and generous scheme to assist and to provide accommodation for all those who are in need of full-time care.
Okay.
Now, that has not been in lights, but if the system evolves, I don't think you can ignore that.
All right, but, and I'm not purposely trying to be emotive here, but you can imagine going back to the times that we talk of where someone was in hospital getting care and being told that the house had to be sold to provide that care, that everything they'd worked for was to go down the drain, that they knew in their final months or years of life that really all they thought they were leaving to their loved ones was gone. What the next generation may have had taken from them. And I say, I'm not purposely trying to be emotive, but sometimes someone has to pay, or at least someone has to say sorry, or someone has to say, we actually did wrong. Not in leaked documents, pat yourselves on the back and say, this policy we're adopting is working, keep her lit. And I say, I know it sounds like...
I have to say, emotive example. There's no doubt about that. It's a emotive example. It has been used this week by opposition, that type of example. There's no... And again, of course, on a human level, you would understand it perfectly. But from a legal point of view, that side of it is slightly different than the disability payments, because it has never been decided that for those that were in private nursing care at that particular time, whether that... the tariff was where the state were obligated to pick that up. They were obligated to redress and to reimburse those who were in public care. And in fact, in 2006 or thereabouts, just preceding the Nursing Home Support Scheme Act, in 2006, a redress scheme was introduced for that. It was passed in the Dáil. It was an act passed then in 2006 to reimburse those that were in public care and they were charged and shouldn't have been. The case that you now refer to, if it was in private care, there was one, I know that of some that were settled again in the doors of court, but it was never actually tried in court. So that point has not actually been proven yet.
Okay, we're still in the company of Seamus Gunn and McLaughlin Gunn and Co, Letterkenny and Remelton. Right, I bought a new van in July 2018. It had a 5-year warranty. In January this year, I went to get a few things done before the warranty runs out, but I was told it was out of warranty. I was told once the year 2023 kicked in, it was out. How can this be right? If I bought it in July, surely it should end in July 2012 and not January. Sounds like calendar year's job here, Seamus.
It does. It's unusual. It is unusual, and you could understand how the caller would be raising an issue with it. And now we don't have access to the warranty, and that's very important. And I've said it before, and we've referenced it many times, that the devil is in the detail in these and the terms and conditions that do apply. But on the face of it, though, and a reasonable interpretation would be that on the date of purchase, and we're assuming now that it's purchased on the basis of it's a brand new vehicle. I think that that's quite important here, because if there's some warranty already used up, it could very well be on the calendar year or thereabouts. But if it was first registered to the individual, the caller, in July, it carried that warranty, it's not unreasonable for him to assume that it would run from that particular date and have 5 years. And there's also usually a 5 year or so many kilometres on these, depending on what make of vehicle that you're going for. So I would be inclined for him to actually, first of all, check out the detail on it. A reputable dealer, which they all are, will certainly, I'm sure, deal with them in a reasonable manner, and they should do, because, and this is very important, these type of warranty situations go back to the manufacturer, not necessarily the dealer. So the manufacturer will be brought in to cover it ultimately. So it should be protected under that. Mm. But without seeing the warranty itself, I'm not going to make a call on whether it's the calendar year or it's the actual anniversary of the purchase. But if you were looking at it and being the customer, you would anticipate or expect that it was the anniversary of the date of purchase, assuming it was bought brand new.
And the company could be shooting itself in the foot, especially considering these sort of split years for car registration was to encourage car purchases in the second half of the year. If this were, and we don't know, standard practice, all of a sudden people might say, well, I'm going to go back to the start of the year, because at least then I get a full 5 year warranty or whatever it might be.
Yeah. But I mean, in warranties that I have looked at, there could be a grey area in question of interpretation. And to be fair as well to the caller, the manufacturer will take that to its advantage if it can. And that's that's just the ways of the world. But that doesn't mean to say that the caller does not have a good cause to raise the matter, and maybe it may be have to be referenced right back to the manufacturer to deal with it. I wouldn't give up on it that easily.
My son is under a ward of court for almost 5 years. The rules around this have been changed. Does Seamus know when these changes will take place?
Well, it's interesting that should come up, because I think that the caller is referencing the Assisted Decision Making Act, which, although being on our statute books for 5-7 years maybe now, there was an Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act of 2022, believe it or not, brought in to tweak some of the sections of the original act, which has not been enacted. And although that was signed into law at the back end of 22, there has not yet, as far as subject to correction, and I'm always subject to correction, but subject to correction, I do not believe there has been a commencement date yet. But I do understand where the caller is coming from, because there has been correspondence from the Ward of Courts office in such cases where people are taken into wardship, advising them of the new system that's coming into being. But there has not yet been a commencement date as yet, as far as I'm aware. And that the HSE will be very much involved in it moving forward, and it will be a completely new system. And in fact, it's likely that it will abolish the Ward of Court system altogether. But the commencement date is yet awaited, and it has been long since awaited and very badly needed, because this will drastically change wardship and decision making and questions of people's capacity and being partially, well, have capacity or have not, or could have partial capacity for making decisions. So it's a very positive piece of legislation. Again, it has to be fully implemented, and up to last year and the year before, the government did not seem to have the wherewithal, personnel and different departments set up to bring it in.
What happens when the beneficiary of a will passes away? So presumably, maybe if they were if they were going to get something, they haven't received it yet. Does what they were due to get then pass on to the next of kin?
It can do. And the point is this, the way they're referencing the question is interesting, the beneficiary having passed away. So I would therefore assume that the beneficiary has died subsequent to the testator or testatrix. So subsequent to the person who made the will in the first place. If that's the case, then when the beneficiary died, the beneficiary would have been entitled, let's just say it was a bequest of €1,000, and the person passed away, the beneficiary is still alive. Well, then that entitlement to that €1,000 would form part of the beneficiary's estate. It's very important to keep this in mind. If that beneficiary has predeceased the deceased, well, in that situation, that actual bequest could then have lapsed totally. So for the purpose of the question, the beneficiary survived the testator, then that would form part of their estate.
What does it mean to have burden placed on your land? I inherited land with this, and I don't know what the implications are for me.
Well, there are many types of burdens. For example, if you took out a mortgage, one of the most common type of burdens, you buy your home, you get a loan from the bank to place a charge on it, that's a burden on it. That would have to be actually a burden which would have to be discharged if you were selling it on to give clear title to the next person. Another type, though, of burden, which is also extremely common, let's say you're living in an area where there are a number of houses and there are a lot of common areas to do with roads and services. Well, then there would be accesses and rights of way, and they could be registered in relation to your property and could be registered maybe perhaps against your property. For example, if there was access to another house up a particular road that was common to both, well then, but this other party owned that land, well, that burden, that access and easement will be registered on their title in order to give the person a right to pass over it to gain access to their own home. That's a quite a common type of what we would call easement. It could be an easement for other services such as water, sewerage, etc. So there are different types of burden. If they want to check out, they should go to the Property Registration Authority site, and you can conduct a search on your land registry folio to see what burdens are on it and what they entail and what they actually cover. They may require some legal help with that. It wouldn't be unusual, and it probably would be preferential to do so, especially if they want to have easements interpreted legally.
All right. Why is it legal, or how can it be legal, for Bulsarian to refuse legal tender, presumably they mean cash, as payment if they are a government body? Or semi-state, or whatever they are.
Well, I think it's probably down to a management decision, and that's it. With staffing, we all know now, and like it's Bulsarian. There's what there in the days gone by. God be with them. There might have been a driver and a personnel doing cash, etc. That's no longer the situation, and you have the individual in charge of the bus also taking the fares. So I would say that it's simply an in-house management decision. If you want to make more of it than that, it might be something you would go to the ombudsman with. They have a fair point. I mean, and some people just like to deal and pay for their way as they go along in cash, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. No. But it's also the priority, I suppose, and the privilege of whoever is running the business to make management decisions that will suit the way in which they're running it, and in particular to suit and to facilitate and accommodate, in this particular case, the person in charge of the bus.
Seamus, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time on a Friday morning. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Co, Letterkenny, Remelton. And if people want to check you out online as well, Seamus?
Yeah, more than welcome, Greg. Just gunn.ie or donegalslisters.ie. We'll keep it simple.
Indeed. Have a lovely weekend, Seamus. Take care of yourself. All right. Okay, Seamus Gunn there. Back with more on the 9 till noon show after the break. Ireland's bid for glory at Eurovision 23 will take place tonight in the Late Late Show Eurovision special, where Ireland's six hopefuls will battle it out to represent Ireland in Liverpool this May at the 67th Eurovision Song Contest. A third of the artists are from Donegal. Viewers at home will have the opportunity to cast their vote for their favourite song and help to decide who will represent Ireland at this year's Eurovision Song Contest. The winner of tonight's Euro song will then perform at the contest in front of an audience of 160 million people around the world. And the winner will be chosen by the combined votes awarded by the public vote, an international jury and a national jury. The six Eurovision song Euro song competing acts are Adji from West Donegal, Too Good For Your Love. We're going to listen to that now in a second. Connolly, Midnight Summer Night. Wild Youth, We Are One. Wild Youth was supposed to, I think they supported Lewis Capaldi in Belfast. I think they were supposed to anyway in Dublin, but they didn't. Leila Jane, also from County Donegal, is going to be performing Wild. Kay Mooney, NND. Kofi Appiah and the Nevlone Damper, Down in the Rain. And then Public Image Limited, their song Hawaii, which has got a lot of press. We'll see how we get on. Right, let's listen to Adji and let's listen to Leila Jane now and let's back them tonight. They are representing Donegal themselves, primarily their families, and we want to give them every chance and every success. So I'm going to be watching, I'm going to be voting. Let's listen. Tell us how you think these two songs will fare tonight.
One more time, tell me if you love me. One more time, it's okay not to feel the same. One more time, the world is ending. One more time, people they chase. Nobody knows what tomorrow holds. But if you ask me today, I'd never let you go. Sometimes we break and we all make mistakes. Why you still hold the rope? I need to let you know.
That's not the song he's singing tonight. I don't know why I'm playing that one. That's a different one. I'll get the song he's actually going to perform tonight, which is called Too Good For Your Love, in a moment. We'll listen to Leila Jane, then I'll come back with Adji. That is Leila Jane Wild. I think that is... I'm not going to lie and say it's going to be in my Spotify playlist or what have you, but I think that really is a very, very good song and could win the Eurovision, as I believe this too could from Adji. Another cracking song. What do you think of this one?
I've been thinking for a while, thought I was missing you. Not like the last time, cause this time I'm not the person you knew. I'm not gonna wait here for you to come back. Tell you that I want you back. Hope you're not waiting for I'm missing you, cause that message isn't coming through. I have made up my mind up, baby. I have grown up, I'm not your babe no more. I have learned from the lessons you gave me. I have learned that I'm too good for your love. Your love, love, I'm too good for your love. Your love, love, your
stone, like lightning struck me down. And now I see our love was so wrong. How did it go so long? I'm not gonna wait here for you to come back. Tell you that I want you back. Hope you're not waiting for missing you, 'cause that message isn't coming through. I have made up my mind up, baby. I have grown up, I'm not your babe no more. I have learned from the lessons you gave me. I'm too good for your life.
Oh, I feel like Ivan Borland here. All right, that is Aggie, Never Let You Go. And we also heard Layla Jane Wild. What do you think? I think they are two crackers. And Donegal should be representing Ireland at the Eurovision Song Contest. But sure, what does it matter what I think?